Louisiana funk, second line chopping, umbrellas in the air when there's no rain fall. Pretty girl from the barrio, sweet kisses, I love how she flies like a bird. And cream, blackberry soda, cruising in the Benz by the city. Your lips on mine, Texas summer nights, feeling the buzz with my brothers.
Facing the dashboard lights, the way the street smells after the rains, staying out until the sun comes up, the highs and the lows, the good times and the bad times, reminiscing on the sweet moments of my childhood.
You're now listening to My Sunday Morning Take, the show where we dive into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else in between to help you make sense of how it works around you from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Sunday. Want to take a trip through history's major events or explore interesting geographical features and even some interesting scientific developments? Well, join us on My Sunday Morning Take every Sunday morning from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. where we look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else to help you understand what is happening in the world. And good morning, dear listeners. Yes, this obviously being an interesting morning, besides the interesting World Cup kickoff and besides the, well, I won't say interesting time frames because I see that Haiti and Scotland just ended specifically. And, I mean, as we are starting a new day, it's a bit weird that in the US they just ended a day. But that's specifically how the natural world works and specifically how the time flows. I know someone in China, they are 6 hours ahead of time. For them, they've already got, 6 hours from now is basically what, 11 in the morning, on their side of the world. And here where the World Cup is taking place, it's literally at the opposite end of the spectrum. And obviously, if you are following the World Cup itself, good luck. Obviously, I do hope that your particular fan favorite team is making it. I feel sorry for the South Africans, just to let you know. What could they expect? And secondly, thirdly, welcome to this morning's My Sunday Morning Take here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And we have an interesting particular conversation that is lined up for this morning. Once again, it'll be on the historical side of life, but it'll be on the scenario specifically of looking back at where have we seen, okay, let me rather say it this way. Not where, but there is a particular scenario that is way bigger than the Iraq war, than the Afghan war, and specifically even this 100-day-plus conflict with Iran even. And this had been a discussion specifically that comes through when on the 13th of June 1971, the New York Times at the time and the Washington Post at the time, literally that's yesterday, began publishing something known as the Pentagon Papers. No, they are not similar to the Panama Papers. The Panama Papers were looking at the financial, basically the dark side of the financial system, specifically how money is hidden from countries who try to collect tax from the various, if you can say, institutions, businesses, people, private individuals, entities, and how that money is taken offshore and hidden. The Panama Papers obviously leads to the next one. There's one after it, slightly smaller than, because it comes out of the Panama Papers. But the Pentagon Papers is something completely different. The Pentagon Papers literally highlights a circumvention of the, basically, public trust, firstly, and thirdly, the discussion of for how long has a country been involved in a conflict in a different part of the world that its own citizens did not even know that there was a conflict that they were participating in even. Now, obviously you can see by the time frame and by the date, 13 June 1971, which was literally basically yesterday, and it speaks towards the involvement of the American Army in Vietnam. To be more precise, the vicinity and the neighborhood of the three countries of Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam today. It was beforehand the known as French Indochina, that particular cluster of three countries was known as French Indochina. And one of the particular things was that no one knew from the American side for how long the Americans were basically present in this vicinity of the world. And the Americans still had their base at the Philippines. They obviously had recently, at that time, not recently today, recently that time, had opened up their particular operations and their base in Japan. So you can obviously see that there's literally like two avenues from where the Americans, they basically can supply from to be involved in French Indochina. Then there's also the scenario specifically that French Indochina is and was a colony of France. But at the time, France, literally after the Second World War, had a lot of internal issues to firstly sort out. They had a lot of particular sort of like commitments to first make. At the same particular time, obviously, before 1971, Algeria started, demanding independence from France, and then the French went all full on gung-ho in terms of trying to quash the Algerian sort of like calls for independence. That in its own self, we have done that particular chapter. It was a very ugly chapter, specifically in Algeria's history. But we didn't know that because the French were trying to concentrate this side on internal affairs and on Algeria, that they had asked the British, first it was the British, then they asked the Americans to please come and play at some sort of administration involvement role in French Indochina. Now, the Pentagon Papers spans literally four presidencies. The Iraq War doesn't span four presidencies. The Afghan occupation probably does span four presidencies. It literally does span four presidencies. But that was a 20-year period. If you had to pull the discussion in terms of full-on conflict when it was not a conflict scenario leading up to an actual war, because if you look up when did the Vietnam War end, that was somewhere also in the 70s, after 71, but it literally ended in 1975. Now, in context, it technically ran from 1955 to 1975. Let me say it again. It technically ran from 1955 to 1975. Continuous conflict. Not even Afghanistan, with its 20-year occupation, specifically by NATO forces, had 20 years of war. I'll say it again. Not even Afghanistan had 20 years of war. Vietnam saw 20 years of war. So did Laos, and so did Cambodia. They saw 20 years of instability and 20 years of conflict. 20 years of violence and 20 years specifically of continuous, you know, combat taking place. When you take into context, okay, so that's the 20-year period. But obviously, in the Indochina occupation by France is something that obviously speaks towards the particular involvement of how the French, you know, for how long the French were involved. Because the French were there literally just a year before that Vietnam War began. The French were there until 1954, from 1887 to 1954. And the particularly important thing that stems out from that was that you can obviously see, so the French literally ceased to be involved in the area of Indochina a year before the Vietnam War begins, which begins in 1955. So now that I've laid the particular background there for you, in terms of understanding the involvement of two particular global powers in that vicinity of Asia, here's where things get interesting. Now, when the Pentagon Papers came out, it was funny how they actually got out. So the Pentagon Papers, as mentioned, you can view them similar even to like the Panama Papers in terms of the size and the scale and the involvement of presidencies in the US back then in terms of this particular conflict. But what you have to look into is the specific manner in which it was unveiled, that it was released or unveiled. So, before we actually continue, dear listeners, we're quickly going to be taking a short ad break, and we're going to come back right after that, and we're going to get into the funny side of how the Pentagon Papers were unveiled.
Join us for the Ehangano Concert Volume 2 with Ali Tobias. Experience an unforgettable evening featuring songs from her latest album, Ain't Bilo, performed live with a full band. Special guest appearances by Tate Boti, DA, Paige, and One Accord. All proceeds from the event will go towards supporting the Our Lady Orphanage. The event takes place on 4 July 2026 at the National Theatre of Namibia. Tickets are available on Web Tickets Namibia for 450 Namibian dollars. Don't miss this powerful night of music, inspiration, and giving back. Ihangano Concert Volume 2. See you there.
Coming back from the quick break right there, dear listeners, and you are here on my Sunday morning take, obviously where you're in my time from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, and specifically where we get into interesting conversations here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And just before the break where we left off, it was the particular time frame that I wanted to highlight to you, and specifically the manner in which the Pentagon Papers were actually released. So what was funny about the release was basically there was one man at the center of all this particular discussion. Now, this guy, Daniel Ellsberg, technically at the time, he was working for the American government. Now, if you go and look him up, it would say that he's a political activist, an economist, and a former U.S. military analyst. So let's just remember those three particular terms. Now, Ellsberg, testified at an unofficial House of Representatives panel investigation discussion. Okay, it can't be a panel discussion because it literally is a panel hearing. It's like these commissions that we've been seeing taking place in South Africa, specifically about major particular developments in the governance of South African institutions. So we saw the one that Zuma refused to show up, and then you had the current one taking place. There was another one, obviously, the ad hoc involvement by the ad hoc committee that interviewed the police guy specifically when he started making his particular accusations last year, but the Americans obviously had a similar one specifically where Ellsberg began talking. Now, Ellsberg spoke at one such particular unofficial House of Representatives panel committee that asked him, hey, listen, come and explain to us, why did you release these documents? Now, the papers contain a history of the U.S.'s role in Indochina from the Second World War until May 1968. It's a very large period to cover, because that's 23 years in its own right. And specifically, that the papers were commissioned in 1967 by the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Robert S. McNamara. Now, they turned out, they were turned over without authorization, obviously without authorization, to the New York Times at the time by Daniel Ellsberg, who was a senior researcher that was associated at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Center for International Relations. Now, Ellsberg, this is one of the interesting and slightly tongue-in-cheek scenarios. The 47-volume history. Yes. So many papers that it literally is 47 volumes that consists of approximately 3,000 pages of narrative. And narrative is something that is, it gives account and details into, you know, people, places, events, and so on. And then 4,000 pages of appended documents, meaning appendices, which took 18 months to complete, a year and a half. And Ellsberg, who worked on the project, had been an ardent early supporter of the U.S.'s role in Indochina. Hence the reason why I said it is very interesting when you hear this. Now, we have to understand, guys, at the time, specifically after the Second World War, primarily the world, you know, didn't have much information going around. And primarily, if you weren't in certain particular key institutions and key zones, you would not know of the particular developments that, for example, your country would be participating in. Now, Ellsberg, unfortunately for him, by the end of the project's end, specifically that being the, you know, the compilation of these documents, had become seriously opposed to U.S. involvement in Indochina, because he felt that he was compelled to reveal the nature of the U.S.'s participation and began and decided to leak major portions of the papers to the press. Now, what he did is he first leaked it to the New York Times, and then he leaked it to the Washington Post. Now, here's where things get interesting. So, the U.S. authorities at the time decided to go and start these legal challenges against the two media companies. On 13 June of 1971, the New York Times began publishing a series of articles based on the study, because he literally made it a report of all these documents, these 7,000 documents, which was classified as top secret by the federal government, you know, in terms of the availability, because these documents only get released like after 40 or 50 years, then they start declassifying documents. I mean, it's sometimes interesting to see. It's even one of the reasons why, what's that guy's name? I almost said the podcaster, but okay, basically Joe Rogan stuff is in many cases, you know, always, if you see it on YouTube, it's always after it had been, you know, conducted live somewhere else on another platform. So Rogan loves interviewing guys who would go through these declassified documents from the U.S. government. There's another guy who loves talking to, what's that former CIA guy's name? John Kiriakos. But I keep forgetting the podcaster guy that interviews him every time. Now, the same podcast guy loves interviewing another sort of like crime historian from New York. And you wouldn't believe it. The guy he interviews sometimes is a guy that was, what I could discern, was a former mafia insider. Literally Italian mafia insider. And one of the reasons as to why he would interview many of these particular guys is that they've got books. They wrote books. They tell their story about their lives in certain particular events. And they release the books. If you go look up the name John Kiriakos, you would find out that he was also involved in a major particular controversy in the U.S. Intelligence community, specifically in the U.S. internally, because he was dragged to court for one other particular thing that he did, and he also then decided to exit the service. And it also brought him into further hot water now that he's slightly more mainstream than he is today. Okay, not than he is today, what he was back then. The scenario obviously means that he's now a lot more bigger in terms of the public profile that Kiriakos now obviously has. But Kiriakos, you know, in many cases, he has to wait for certain particular things, the time frame also to end, in terms of revealing anything, obviously, because he's still alive. Many other people that he worked with are obviously still alive. So obviously, anything he says and the knowledge that he has in his brain is technically considered basically national security worthy. However, However, the promises, for example, if you also look at this discussion with regards to how certain documents sometimes get released, is even in the context of what Donald Trump promised as one of his campaign promises, he would release a whole tranche of documents specifically by declassifying them, by trying to understand what happened to Martin Luther King, who actually assassinated him, and was there any particular linkage in terms of Martin Luther King's assassination and JFK's assassination. And then he also made the other promise of, obviously, the Epstein files, releasing those particular files into the public domain. The concern, obviously, was that he probably, as a president, didn't realize that his name would appear more than 1,000 times in those documents. But obviously, hey, man, no one is complaining except just for him and his particular, Secretary of Justice. Now, if you're looking at the dimension of making available documentation and information specifically that spans a period of time, for example, like what is currently in the contemporary scenario, the Epstein files, is a scenario of whether you look at, what's the public interest value in this dimension? Well, with the Epstein files scenario, there obviously has been accusations made by victims, and the victims have even been technically highlighted as being genuine victims of crimes, of sexual crimes specifically that were allegedly committed by this man who's now deceased. So now, that is the particular public, interest dimension. This other public interest dimension was hidden from the public itself. The scenario in this particular case, also with the Pentagon Papers, was a dimension of why were they in another war without their country knowing of a war? So, when the particular sort of like leaks started happening from Ellsberg to the two media companies, on 31 June, the New York Times began publishing a series of these articles that were based on the study, which technically was still classified as top secret because it was still within that period and the Americans were still in Vietnam. Now, after a third daily installment, meaning day three of publishing by the New York Times, and after it appeared in the Times itself, the U.S. Department of Justice at the time obtained in a U.S. district court a temporary restraining court order against further publication of these classified materials, and the defense that they made regarding this, or the claim that they made in this particular restraining order, was that further public dissemination of the material would cause immediate and irreparable harm to U.S. national defense interests. Now, the Times, which later on was then being joined by the Washington Post, which was also in possession of a tranche of these documents, because remember, Ellsberg released to both entities. He didn't ask the Times send it to the Post. He went to the Washington Post here, and he went to the New York Times over there, and he said, hey, listen, guys, I've got these sets of information. Here you go. Have a read. They both fought the order through the courts for the next 15 days. During this particular time, publication of the series was technically suspended. So there was three publications, and then obviously the court battle came in, and then everything was suspended, was kept on hold until it had been completed. Now, before we actually continue, dear listeners, because we're going to take another short break, and we're going to come back right after this.
Großartige Neuigkeiten. Imba ist jetzt noch besser geworden. Wir haben brandneue Funktionen hinzugefügt, um dein Erlebnis noch reibungsloser, schneller und leistungsstärker zu machen als je zuvor. Bereit, das volle Potenzial von Imba freizuschalten? Erhalte alle exklusiven Funktionen für nur 36 Namibia-Dollar pro Monat oder spare noch mehr mit unserem speziellen Abonnementplänen. 5% Rabatt bei einem 3-Monats-Abonnement, 10% Rabatt bei einem 6-Monats-Abonnement oder 25% Rabatt bei einem 12-Monats-Abonnement. Wähle den Plan, der am besten zu dir passt und genieße alles, was Imba zu bieten hat, zu einem unschlagbaren Preis. Imba, where the world congregates. Lade es herunter und abonniere noch heute.
So we come back from the quick break right there, and here on my Sunday Morning Take, here on your number one talk radio station, we left off, we're technically picking up where we left off with regards to our discussion about the, you know, the Pentagon Papers and the particular developments that led from there. Now, obviously for the next 15 days from the 13th of June 1971, you know, no further particular publications of the particular Pentagon Papers took place, since the court battle was still ongoing. On 30 June 1971, however, things change. Now, this is regarded as one of the most significant prior restraint cases in history. This is as the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 6-3 decision, freed the newspapers to resume publishing the material. The court held that the government had failed to justify restraint of said publication. So, this is as the Pentagon Papers then revealed that since Harry S. Truman, U.S. President right after the Second World War, and his administration gave military aid to France in its colonial war against the communist-led Viet Minh, thus directly also involving the United States in Vietnam. Then, at that stage, with the following president, which was my namesake, Dwight D. Eisenhower, in 1954, decided to prevent a communist takeover of South Vietnam and to undermine the new communist regime of North Vietnam. Then followed into the following presidency right after Eisenhower, with JFK's particular sort of like entering the fray and entering the particular picture, where his administration then transformed the policy of limited risk gamble that Kennedy had inherited into a policy of broad commitment. So limited risk was trying to say, hey, listen, we'll give support, we'll give cash, like technically what's happening with the Ukraine, but we won't be present. That was limited risk gamble, which then Kennedy took it from limited risk to literally broad commitment. Broad commitment now means, yes, we will send boots wherever. Yes, we will fly to that place, go dust up and give a blue eye or black eye or whenever, and then we come back. That's literally what broad commitment means. And then, ending specifically with the last U.S. president, Lyndon B. Johnson, who then intensified the covert warfare against the North Vietnamese and began planning to wage a covert and overt war in 1964. A full year before, the actual depth of the U.S. involvement was actually publicly revealed, which was in 1965. Because in many cases, people will ask you, okay, so the actual length of the war, of the Vietnam War that the Americans fought, many believe it's from 1965 to 75. Many people. But obviously, the length is a lot longer. Because the Americans were supporting or maintaining French control over the three countries that are now Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam since 1955. Now, Johnson then also ordered, and it was also revealed in the Pentagon Papers, where Johnson also ordered the bombing of North Vietnam in 1965, despite the judgment of the U.S. intelligence community that it would not cause the North Vietnamese to cease their support of Viet Cong insurgency into South Vietnam. Now, at the time, Vietnam was literally... Okay, what happened to Vietnam was literally similar to what happened with the Korean Peninsula, was that the two Koreas were created. Now, North Korea, in all honesty, guys, when you go and read about North Korea's particular capabilities at the time to basically take control of the whole Korean Peninsula, is that North Korea literally had the guns, they had basically a lot of the trained soldiers, and the South Vietnamese, unfortunately, didn't have anything. They tried specifically, you know, maintaining a particular position, but the position was that the South Vietnamese were very, very weak, specifically in terms of numbers, supply, guns, basically, armaments, and more. Now, when looking at this particular scenario specifically of what happened in with Vietnam in terms of the same particular thinking of splitting a whole country into two halves and then telling, let's say, one political actor who technically is a communist, you know, on the one side and supposedly saying, yes, you guys that now must form part of the, what was the term they used back then? The free world. You are now going to be supported by having a US army base there in your neighborhood or there in your country. Now, the South Vietnamese, unfortunately, were not on the same particular sort of like ideological perspective of the South Koreans, because the South Koreans were like, you know what? We technically don't like this thing of communism. We technically don't like this thing of, you know, basically having to fight each other a lot. But there is an actual fear specifically of this complete collapse of, you know, just economic advancement that the Koreans actually wanted to achieve, because the Koreans obviously went from Japanese occupation now to the threat specifically of one or other form or format of occupation potentially through one or other particular communist involvement. That was also the fear that the Polish had at the same, in the same particular scenario. It's the fear that the Hungarians had. The Hungarians were the ones actually who were technically invaded. Hence, the Hungarians technically don't. If you look at it historically, the Hungarians technically don't like anything Russian. They don't. For some reason, I was very surprised in terms of why they had a lead national leader like Viktor Orban, who was very cozy, specifically with Russia, specifically because he spoke in defense of Russia. But he made a lot of sense specifically. I mean, in the new age, why are people going to war, specifically in this modern particular time? The Polish don't like anything Russian because of what happened with them. Who else was there? The Slovaks, the same, and the Czechs. The Slovaks, the Czechs, and the Poles, and the Hungarians don't like anything Russian, specifically because of the colonization that they experienced under the Cold War scenario. The East Germans, well, you know, I haven't read enough about life in East Germany in terms of how the East Germans feel after the fall of the Soviet Union. But let's just say, just as much as there are people who don't like what the Americans were doing and what the British and the French did, there's also not a lot of people in the world who don't like what the Russians did or the Soviets did. Let's just put it out there as well. So when you look at these particular scenarios in terms of the discussion of the involvement that the Americans had in French Indochina or in Indochina specifically, is that the information brought to the fore a discussion that the American public thought they knew but did not know. Now, the release of the papers stirred nationwide and also international controversy, because it also occurred after several years of growing dissent over the legal and moral justification of the intensifying U.S. involvement and its actions in Vietnam. Because the public at the time were trying to understand what's going on here with Vietnam. Where is Vietnam? Now, the, what was the guy's name? Jiang, the educator Jiang Xueqing, he explained it very nicely, specifically that the Americans used mission creep in Vietnam. So mission creep is when you don't announce and nor do you say that your country is involved in a war in another part of the world, but you just see an increase in defense spending or in defense budget allocation. Now, this technically would mean, if, you know, since I described this particular scenario to you, that it means that every president from Truman to Johnson were aware the moment that they were voted into office and became president of the United States, in every scenario, they were aware, literally, that they have to commit money and resources to sustaining something on the other side of the world. And, for example, like the one documentary that I watched, where the guy said, literally, the one speaker literally said, listen, not many people in the US back then knew where a place like Vietnam was. Not many people back then, had a clue of what the world looked like outside of their country, outside of the United States. Why am I explaining that? Because the US, if you look at like tourism, in honesty for the US, the Americans are like the French, what they also describe the French to be. The Americans are like the French. They travel in their country. You know, they, if you are in New York, you decide, you know what, I'm going to fly to Los Angeles and I'm going to go and stay there for the holiday. They do that a lot. They drove across the country. They visited their parks. They visited their various the areas. So in that case, many people were literally, they didn't know where many of these other particular developments were happening around the world. They didn't know where was Vietnam. They probably didn't know even of a continent named Africa. Now, these particular indications obviously should tell you that this scenario highlighted the scale of shock to many of these Americans, because they were wondering, okay, so we know that, you know, there's this open conflict or this open apprehension that the US government has against the Soviet Union and any other communist country around the world. But they did not know that they were literally invested in an actual conflict that is taking place somewhere else. Now, the disclosures and the particular continued publication, despite the top secret classification, was also embarrassing for the administration at the time of the fifth president, right after Johnson, guess who? Richard Nixon, who was preparing to seek re-election in 1972. Now, it was so distressing in terms of what these revelations of the Pentagon Papers were basically bringing to the fore, that Nixon actually authorized unlawful efforts to discredit Ellsberg. So technically, he authorized potentially the intelligence apparatus of the US government to try and undermine or make Ellsberg look bad in the public eye. And then it included burglarizing the Beverly Hills office of Ellsberg's psychiatrist in an attempt to also unearth any embarrassing information in the burglary. But it was also masterminded by one of Nixon's, what was called a plumber, put that in inverted commas, because they apparently named themselves for their ability to repair leaks of information damaging to the president. which was also a former intelligence operative known as Howard Hunt. Well, he apparently has an E in front of him. But these efforts also came to light during the investigation of the Watergate scandal. And the Watergate scandal literally was the sort of like coup de grace of Nixon's particular administration, because Nixon tried to literally undermine the elections results. Well, not actually undermine the elections results, because the people actually broke into the opposition party's office. That was the interesting thing. Now, the papers were subsequently published into a book form known as the Pentagon Papers by the same name in 1971. However, the leaked documents were incomplete, and certain portions also remained classified up until 2011, like I told you, when the full study was released to the public as well. Now, this particular interesting development obviously sort of like lays down the groundwork, and yes, we did reach the midway point of our discussion. We'll quickly be taking a short musical break, dear listeners, and after it, we'll come back heading into the second half of this morning's discussion, specifically getting into some of the, I'd like to call them the various chapters that the Pentagon Papers actually focus on. And on that note, dear listeners, we'll be back right after this.
Stone washed denim with a long crease in them in my snakeskin boots. I like my GTO down a two-lane road with an open windshield view. I'm telling the truth, baby, they got nothing on you. I can wear my Chanel watch, but nothing makes the time stop like you walking in a room. Just like the diamonds on my grill, all the way you make me feel like a special kind of fool. Yeah, it's true, baby, they ain't got nothing on you. All the gold in the world, no, it don't mean much. Can't take you with you when your time is up. All the shine of the crown might be good for looking, but when it all breaks down, oh, they ain't got nothing on you. Like a lake down south where we all hang out with the Texas barbecue. Like the sound of a song on my old guitar, laying down some two or two. Yeah, it's true, baby, they ain't got nothing on you. How are you? All the gold in the world, no, it don't mean much. Can't take you with you when your time is up. All the shine of the crown might be good for looking, when it all breaks down, oh, they ain't got nothing on you. Oh, you. You. Baby. Time is up. All the shine of the crown might be good for looking, when it all breaks down, no, they ain't got nothing on you. They ain't got nothing on you. Oh, you. No, they ain't got nothing on. They ain't got nothing on.
Coming back and welcoming you once again. If you've just woken up, it is just past the midway point of this morning's programming, which technically means it's, you know, past 6 a.m. But if you were just waking up, good morning. do hope you've got something hot or warm in your palm at least, or that you're just obviously just, you know, just going about the, you know, your daily movements as early as possible. This is my Sunday morning take here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And where we left off just before the break was literally looking into the Pentagon Papers that came out technically on 13 June 1971. But the last batch of it was technically released back in 2011. And all of this was released by an academic who was also an analyst involved in one way or another, specifically with the U.S. government itself. Yeah, because many cases you sometimes wonder, how did the person get the information? And it is always wonderful when you read up about the particular actions of peoples, how they did this. Then you realize, oh, it's because you are involved in the thing specifically. So, yeah. So Ellsberg was involved in basically in one other capacity specifically in the discussion of the information that he collected and how he came upon it. Now, what we've obviously got to be looking into is that the particular contents of the particular, you know, sets of information and how the documents are actually organized. Now, the study, as mentioned, covered 3,000 pages of historical analysis and 4,000 pages of original government documents in 47 volumes. Volumes. So volume is a book by itself. And it was also classified as top secret and sensitive. Specifically, the sensitive was not designated as an official security designation at the time, but it also meant that the access to the study should be controlled specifically. There was also a scenario in terms of where a task force that was constituted at the time made 15 copies. The think tank Rand Corporation received two of the copies from someone. This is obviously one of the particular persons that were also involved in this particular discussion. And so to also a handful of individuals who were also granted access for at least two or three of them that were actually approved. Now, I just want to highlight this one particular scenario. This one scenario is actually based upon the involvement, for example, of the Secretary of Defense at the time of the U.S. when these documents came out in 1971, which was Robert McNamara, is that McNamara went on to become the president of the World Bank at the time. Back then in the 60s. And he was approached by this individual by the name of Gelb. If you don't know who Gelb also is, specifically, it's someone by the name of Leslie Gelb. Leslie Howard Gelb was an American government official, an academic, and also a journalist. And specifically, he was a correspondent and a columnist for the New York Times, and he also served as the fourth director of Bureau of Political Military Affairs from 77 to 79. Wow. Very involved, specifically. Now, as you could see here, the information obviously was released in various sort of like installations that were pretty big, but how the information was organized and the content of the information is what is interesting that you should look at, and the time scale that it obviously looks into. So the volumes, as mentioned, are monumental because there are 47 of them, but I will give you volumes in terms of collections. Now, there are seven of these particular volumes. Of these collections. No, sorry, six of these particular volumes of these collections. And each one of them have, so let's say chapters in them. Let me use chapters for now. Now, when you start off with the first one, this takes you from the period of 1940 to 1950, and this is labeled as Vietnam and the United States. In this particular period, they look at U.S. policy, foreign policy. Then they look at the character and the power, specifically of the Viet Minh. And then thirdly, they look at Ho Chi Minh, who is also classified as being possibly an Asian Tito. If you don't know who Tito was, Tito is the guy of, I think he's the guy of Yugoslavia. Josip Broz Tito, the guy of Yugoslavia. He was the communist revolutionary and also politician who led Yugoslavia's president for 20 years, 43 to 63, and then as president from 53 to his death in 1980. Tito was also the guy that started the non-aligned movement, if you guys remember that. That's also an entity that Namibia is somewhat part of. I say somewhat, because you don't hear this particular cluster of countries get together and have a big hoo-ha every year. You just don't. But we form much of the Global South technically subscribes to this thing known as the non-aligned movement. So in Tito's particular scenario, Tito, if you go and view any particular documentaries out there, you will hear that the analysis says that Tito does not want to be controlled by Moscow, nor does he want to be controlled by anyone in the West. Tito wanted to sort of like be neutral, do his own thing, concentrate on the affairs in his country, and then try to steer the country into a particular pathway that sees that there's some actual positive development for the whole nation. But things are obviously not always as straightforward and as simplistic as I just described it in any scenario or in any case. Why? Because you always have just weird things happening in many cases. So with this particular development that obviously pops up in terms of how the Pentagon Papers are arranged. So Ho Chi Minh is an actual person, if you guys don't know. Ho Chi Minh was also obviously had a particular analysis done on him, obviously by the Americans, because Ho Chi Minh was obviously sort of like the brains trust of this new Vietnamese, Indochinese independence movement there in South Asia. And the idea was, let's understand who this guy is. And it has happened across history as well. Now, the second volume, which only also just has, like one chapter in it, looks at U.S. involvement in the Franco-Viet Minh War of 1950 to 1954. This is obviously as the analysis focuses firstly on the U.S., France, and the Vietnamese nationalism momentum. And the second of these particular chapters looks at towards a negotiated settlement in that regard. Now remember, the Vietnamese were pushing for independence. So too the Cambodians, and so too the, is it Laotians? Do I say Laotians? And so too the people of Laos. In volume 3, this then gets into the Geneva Accords, international rules, international law, which is now regularly broken, that it technically looks like, or probably it looks like an afterthought of any kind, because no one seems to be following international law, but everybody else everybody else is literally told, follow international law. Now, here is where they look into the U.S. military planning and diplomatic maneuvering. They then look into the role and the obligations of the state of the Vietnam. Then they look at Viet Minh positions and the Sino-Soviet strategy. So this means the proximity of Vietnam to China, and obviously China to the Soviet Union is a particular direction that they also looked at. And finally, the last chapter being the intent of the Geneva Accords. Now, volume 4 goes into a different direction. This obviously goes into full-on assessment of military strategy. Now, volume 4 is pretty big. It literally has 26 chapters in it. So, volume 4 goes by the following. There is the U.S. Map for Diem. This means the Eisenhower commitments of 1954 to 1960. It has 5 chapters in it. They look here at NATO and SEATO, a comparison. They look at aid for France and Indochina from 1950 to 54. They look at U.S. and France's withdrawal from Vietnam in 54 to 56. And they look at the U.S. training of Vietnamese National Army, that's now the South Vietnamese, in 54 to 59, and then the origins of the insurgency that started taking place. The second chapter, which has literally 5 chapters within that, is counterinsurgency and the Kennedy commitments. This is from the period of 1961 to 63. They looked at Kennedy's commitments and his programs. They looked at the strategic Hamlet program. They looked at the advisory buildup, meaning the role in terms of how the U.S. systematically crept into this war, into full-blown conflict with the North Vietnamese specifically. They then also looked at phased withdrawal of the U.S. forces in Vietnam from 62 to 64. And then the overthrow of Ngo Dinh Diem, from the period of May to November of 1963. Now, what many people never hear of this particular part of history specifically was the level to which the Americans actually made things worse. Now, the scenario was that the Vietnamese, technically the South Vietnamese, they didn't want to fight. They did not want to fight. However, the leader that was put in, this Diem guy, Diem wanted to literally become a military dictator himself. But Diem was saying yes to things from the Americans, and his actions obviously weren't doing the same thing or were not corresponding as well. And Diem also, it's difficult to say, because Diem literally was like Chiang Kai-shek and Mao. They knew each other. They literally knew each other. Diem and Ho Chi Minh basically knew of each other. Diem obviously went with the evil that seemed to him to be a little bit lesser than a communist Soviet evil. I use this term just as an indicator, guys, not calling anyone actually evil. I wasn't there. I don't know them. But Diem tried to run a little bit of his own little mini authoritarian situation in South Vietnam. And the North Vietnamese loved this, because the North Vietnamese knew that they could play a role. They could use this particular direction of the South Vietnamese government against it. and then literally weaken the South Vietnamese government's particular position, because the border was not as well protected or patrolled. Many people in the rural areas of South Vietnam were in support of the Viet Cong. And the Viet Cong knew they had more support from the average South Vietnamese person than the elites in the South Vietnamese societal structures. So I'm talking about the politicians, the business people, and so on and so forth. They were the ones that were divorced from the reality of the ground. And so too also the Americans, because the Americans obviously were attached to the, you know, the upper echelons of society in South Vietnam, and they thought they were in control of things. There's this lovely discussion I saw once with this, this one media outlet that I follow on YouTube, where they literally, the guy interviews an author of a book literally about what happened in Vietnam, the American involvement in Vietnam. And this is obviously in terms of trying to understand U.S. foreign policy up until 2026, and specifically where things, you know, like these conflicts, how bad they get. And the historian that is interviewed is an American. And he literally lays down the template of how one man literally undermined the whole South Vietnamese government. And this was an American intelligence officer that was based there. He was former Air Force in the US, but he was based there. And he thought he was training, you know, someone, he trained a local Vietnamese guy who could speak French, who could speak Vietnamese, and who could speak English. And he also organized for this guy to literally go and study English in the US, and then this guy came back. But this guy was actually North Vietnamese. He was actually a North Vietnamese spy. Now, the downside of this particular discussion that I'm also highlighting to you was that the average person on the South Vietnamese side, they didn't care about Western values. What they did not want was to become a puppet state of someone else. What they did not like was the overpervasive presence of American soldiers and American intelligence people in their cities and their communities. What they also did not like was that in many cases, these particular, for example, the Americans did not know. And this is also the post-colonial discussion that you would also find if you read up on post-colonialism yourself. I advise you guys to read up on post-colonialism. The Indians, I'm saying Indian scholars from India, there's a whole bunch of them that position, you know, very good work in terms of analyzing post-colonial life, wherever, from Africa to Asia. And it's a discussion that I've seen specifically how, and in many cases you'd see this with Europeans, they don't understand the concept of not liking being colonized. They don't understand this concept. They don't. They literally don't. And the downside of viewing this particular subject matter is that for you and me, we know that colonialism is a bad thing. We know it. But for some reason, in 2026, you'll have countries like the United States, the UK, some parts of Europe still, and even Israel, not understanding that colonialism is a bad thing. Yes, no one can actually do anything of what America did to Venezuela, which is a colonial situation. Yes, no one can do anything to basically help Cuba. which is also a colonial activity because, I mean, if the whole world has no issue with Cuba, how's it only possible that only the Americans have an issue with Cuba? How is it possible? And suddenly, it's an issue for the whole of the world if China still wants to maintain the one China policy in terms of reintegrating Taiwan into mainland China. Now suddenly the whole world needs to stand behind Taiwan, but yet the Americans are blockading Cuba, an independent country. A country that just didn't like it, that just didn't like the manner and the scale in which the agricultural sector of its country is literally possessed. When I say possessed, I'm not talking about spiritually possessed like a ghost story. I'm talking about because I didn't want to use the word capture. I mean, it sounds dumb. When you listen to capture, it sounds a bit dumb. Capturing sounds like a Robert Louis Stevenson book, kidnapped, in terms of literally being taken into custody of some sort. Yes, it technically would also be legally correct using that term, but taking possession of something, ownership is a completely different thing, would be the applicable phrase to use. Now, in the modern day context, when you view the One China policy and you view the United States' blockade on Cuba, you obviously realize that there is a major contradiction going on here. In one scenario, because China did negotiate this, let's not forget it, they did negotiate this when they were allowed into the UN fold by the Americans. Because it's the Americans that asked the Chinese, please join the UN and please become a UN Security Council member. China laid down these particular points, which would be deemed as non-negotiables, and one of them was the One China policy. America said yes back then. They said yes back then. It's on black and white. America has been blockading Cuba since the 60s, which is illegal. Just because it happened to American businessmen and American businesses, it became a personal sort of like gripe. So Cuba does not belong to America because America never had Cuba. Now, you would then argue, potentially, about, what does this mean in the broader scheme of things and even for your life as a Namibian? Well, because primarily how we need to see the discussion unfolding. We've seen how easy it is under the US President Donald Trump, how easy it is for him just to, start a fight anywhere in the world with any country. And the discussion from this is obviously one of, this technically means if you say one thing specifically, and what you can basically see is that the whole political class around the world is afraid of speaking out against the man. In fear of retribution, in fear of some sort of measure of reaction. Because colonialism is not good, guys. Colonialism is not good. Colonialism is not good. And there are people today who technically don't know. There are literally people on this planet today who technically don't know. They're not told the evils of colonialism. Yes. Yes, roads were built, schools were built. Yes, those things were built. But the downside is, if you go and look at the human rights component of things, if you go look at decent living, access to opportunities, colonialism was not good. It wasn't. Now, we quickly take a short musical break, dear listeners, and after that break, we get back and we head into the last quarter of this morning's discussion here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And we'll be back with the rest of my Sunday morning take right after this.
Understand, but baby, Then you, I can feel the dream, a never-ending frequency. Oh, the sound sublime and in time. You might find another reason, find another reason to live. I'm on your side, so let's find another reason, find another reason to live. Out Gethsemane, a wondrous morning this shall be. Don't you feel divine? And baby, the miracles that come so fast, and you are passing every test with the magic in your mind. And in time, clear to me, the crystal waters running free, the mountains of your soul, baby. The words are flowing out of me, an endless page of psalm to sing, something to delight. Money, if all of this is energy, never-ending frequency, echoing in time, baby. The cave is where I need to be, and I can come out again wherever I like, baby.
And those were the sounds specifically of Richard Ashcroft with the song Find Another Reason. Before that, you had a little bit of Take That with Keep Your Head Up. And we sort of like in the last stretch of this morning's particular show. Now, the volumes itself, specifically where I left off before I went on the anti-colonialism sort of like tangent, you know, just before the musical break, was that you could literally see the particular planning, obviously, in terms of the approach towards that was applied towards Vietnam. Now, obviously, when we left off with the counterinsurgency chapter within the evolution of the war, which in itself has 26 chapters associated to it, the next particular, you know, sort of like the third chapter after the counterinsurgency one, which was the direct action chapter, which speaks towards the period of Lyndon B. Johnson's particular commitments from 64 to 68. This primarily went and looked at the U.S. programs in South Vietnam, the military pressures against the North Vietnamese. It also went and looked at the Rolling Thunder program, which was a time frame in terms of various military operations or involved operations. The Marine Combat Units that obviously were at Go To Da Nang. You also had the U.S. ground strategy and the force deployments taking place. Then there was the air war in the north, re-emphasis on pacification. Then it was the U.S. and Vietnamese revelations, obviously. And then finally, the looking into the statistical survey of the war, the North and the South. The next chapter, this is now chapter 5, or volume 5, basically the next volume, which was the justification of the war, obviously went into things, for example, in terms of public statements that covered 4 presidencies, as outlined. It then went into internal documents. It will then look into internal documents that look at the Roosevelt administration before Truman, then Truman, then Eisenhower, and then the Kennedy administration, and obviously, finally, obviously, also overlapping into the Johnson administration. And then finally, there is the settlement of the conflict, which then takes a look at the period of negotiations. But the two chapters that look at the period of negotiations is the first round of negotiations from 65 to 67. The second round also that looks at also in the same period of 65 to 67. And obviously both in terms of outlining the involved literature that is associated to this particular chapter. And finally, it then goes and looks at a history of contacts, which flows over the extent of various time periods, locations, as well as also potentially involved scenarios. Now, the aim of the Vietnam War was apparently to contain China. This is sort of like the last revelation to leave you with. The aim of the Vietnam War was supposedly to contain China. Not to contain the Soviet Union. I also believed for a very long time that it was the Soviets who were behind the North Vietnamese. It technically was not. It was literally a discussion of looking at proximity, who is closest to who. Now, obviously, since the Korean War was literally in the 1950s, and obviously where the Chinese were directly involved in the Korean conflict, the actual objective of the Vietnam War was identified as the containment of China, which was literally that even though the U.S. president at the time, Lyndon B. Johnson, stated that the aim of the Vietnam War was to secure an independent and non-communist South Vietnam, a January 1965 memorandum by the Assistant Secretary of Defense, John McNaughton, stated that an underlying justification was not to help a friend, but to contain China. So even the poor South Vietnamese were used as cannon fodder. The poor South Vietnamese were used literally as a containment strategy against China. Because on 3 November of 1965, the Secretary of Defense at the time, McNamara, sent a memorandum to Johnson in which he also explained the major policy decisions with respect to our course. This is, I'm now stating a quotation taken from this memorandum. Our course of action in Vietnam. The memorandum begins by disclosing the rationale behind the bombing of North Vietnam in February of 1965, where it continues to go to say, quote, open quotation marks, the February decision to bomb North Vietnam and the July approval of Phase 1 deployments make sense only if they are in support of a long-run United States policy to contain China. So, put a bookmark there. In the last 9 minutes, if you've believed that this sentiment discussion against China, even with what Trump had been stating and saying since last year when he came back into power with the threats of the tariffs and obviously seeking to bring countries to come to him to negotiate instead of him, you know, trying to sort of like say, hey, listen, let's try and do something about this trade deficit discussion that much of the world has with him. And he did have a point. He literally did have a point. But here's the thing. He was trying to reverse 30 years of such economic action in 1 year. And in that 30 years, the US dollar has become more expensive. So the thinking to say, literally for a country like Lesotho or Eswatini, you guys, since we buy so much of your raw materials, you guys have to buy a lot more of our products. But you want to sell a pair of jeans that literally costs $50 in your country. You want to come sell that pair of jeans for $2,000 this side. No one's going to buy your jean. No one. The other particular thing, obviously, is also the indication specifically of this approach is that a country like Vietnam was literally laid to waste. Vietnam and Cambodia. They were literally laid to waste in a strategy that inevitably fell apart in the 1980s. Anyway, it fell apart in the 1980s. Because the Chinese premier at the time, Deng Xiaoping, was obviously, he is known as the sort of like the Chinese leader that led China into the opening up of China, and specifically for, you know, the modernization drive that China went on since the 1980s. Into today, he's accredited with a greater part of starting this particular process of factories being brought to China, of China then becoming the world's factory as well at the same time. So you obviously saw the particular discussions and the things that Donald Trump was complaining about. Other countries have to buy the products of US, have to buy US products also so that US companies can also enjoy something. But here's the downside. It was US companies that were convinced by Ronald Reagan back then in the 80s to take manufacturing jobs from the US to China. There's a book that I've spoken about on the home run here with Helmut, written by, what was the author's name? And the book is sold here in Windhoek anyway, because I saw it at the bookstore that I bought my last book from. It's literally a process of how the Chinese smartphone manufacturers and makers, how they benefited off what Apple had to do in China here in the 2000s, just before the financial crash of 2008-2009. Because they literally trained a lot of factory workers and continuously invested in the same people to scale up their ability to work on the technology of the smartphones. And thus many of these guys went out and started their own smartphones across China. Now I ask you, dear listeners, I ask you, when you look back at the noise that Donald Trump was making of 2026, of 2025, not of 2026, of 2025. 2026's noise is literally warfare. 2025's noise is basically, was basically the tariffs left, right, and center. But 2026 was literally warfare, is literally warfare. If you look back at the language and the actions of the US of 2025, you would be asking a question of, but whose fault was it that you took American factory jobs from the United States to China? Whose fault was that? All the US presidents before Donald Trump, 2025. All, and that includes even Donald Trump of 2016 to 2020. All US presidents took factory jobs from the US to China. They allowed it to happen. As I said, me as a Namibian, myself as a Namibian, when you look in at this in terms of its honesty, you understand what Trump wanted to achieve in 2025. But you can't unfold, you literally can't undo 30 years or 50 years of this action in one go. It is impossible. In one year, Nochal, it is impossible. It is impossible. And the downside is, I mean, I even heard some of the particular rhetoric, even at this EU Namibia Business Forum. The downside is, I still don't understand specifically the anti-Russian sentiment, specifically from a European perspective. Because Europe was colonizing the rest of the world, now we need to understand why they don't like the Russians. I'm like, my goodness, okay. And also, I don't understand the anti-Chinese sentiment. I don't understand either. Because they are primarily just based upon a scenario of competing for the sake of competing. Competing for the sake of competing. Just being competitive for the sake of being competitive. How does that sound to you, dear listeners? Now, before we actually sign out from this morning's particular program, it is an important thing for you to understand. When you study or look into the realm of international relations, you shouldn't just look at what you see with your eyes here in front. Go and read past the point. Go and read in terms of the historical relations of nations with each other, the historical relations of various positions with each other. Understand to the fullest extent what is actually going on in this particular discussion. The reason I say this is specifically that things are sometimes not as, you know, as obvious or as, yes, the information will be easy to find in some cases, but sometimes the discussions are not as easy as they are supposed to be, as they are supposedly made out to be. Before we continue and before we say our goodbyes, we take a short break and come back after it.
If you lost your show, olotali kutungupo. Oma wa o tomono okutako NHP. Genge wa longi fai longi foli lipedulo wa wo haku. Olo halipiti kwa efiku ne fiku. Mefiloshi shelo haku oe. O wa washi mali wa oshosha kupako. Washika wet gelwa kom to alandu la kokashi. Koma punglo e na shano unjolo welewe. Oto dulo okulongi fa oma wa oe. Wa hupuko. Opo una mitito shiningi momikalo dihapungashi. Okufuti lapo oi mali wa ishona. Oyo hodulo okupolwa. Ulifutila ove mwene, omayakulo olu hapu, hakala ina kwa telwa, mouwawe kwa folo elu unamiti. Ile, otojulu no kuli, okupitifapo e mwedidonumba, tokala ino futa ea kulolo elu unamiti. Kowyalele uhapu, talela po nhp.com.na. Ema ngono malandola fwana ododina okulandulwa. NHP, rooted in care for you. Your health.
your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
So coming back, dear listeners, there from the quick break, which technically also signals the end of this morning's particular session of my Sunday Morning Take. It is important, dear listeners, that when you look at the international relations realm, just like the piece of advice I left you with in just before the break, in many cases it goes way deeper. Sometimes it's just a labeling discussion, meaning a country might have had a different name then than it has today, or it was part of a broader territory than it is today, or in some cases it was a different situation than it is today, but you will find still some aspect of connections or connectability even today. For example, as a side note, in terms of how interesting this sometimes is, have you guys ever seen Switzerland's name? Sometimes the naming convention it sometimes takes, specifically internationally, and in some cases also wherever you go, Switzerland is identified as a CH in terms of its abbreviation or its abbreviated name. It doesn't say SWI. Because Sweden is SWE. Who else is there? But Switzerland does not use the SWI indicator, even though it's the only country that is Switzerland, that is SWI. Now, the CH apparently speaks towards a former name of Switzerland. Can you believe this? A former name of Switzerland. This former name of Switzerland was the Helvetic Republic, or the Helvetic Confederation, or the Confederation of Helvetica. That's the name flows like that. This was a former version of Switzerland. This was technically the founding version of Switzerland, which was a sister republic of the French Republic after the French Revolution. Yeah? 1798 or 1788, one of the two time periods. That's a naming convention for how the country of Switzerland gets identified internationally. Internationally. Well, on that particular note, dear listeners, I left you with that little interesting piece of trivia on the particular sort of like in terms of where we find ourselves with this morning's session of my Sunday Morning Take. We've come to the end of this morning's program. Do stay tuned for the rest of your programming in our company, and primarily enjoy the rest of your programming throughout this Sunday. We'll obviously be back next Sunday, same time, same place. Otherwise, alternatively, it's during the course of the week with myself and Helmut here on The Home Run, where we obviously bring you the interesting perspectives into discussions, not just in Namibia, but also from around the continent and around the world. And on that note, dear listeners, enjoy the rest of our programming here for this Sunday morning.